Context. We have some great panelists for you. First, I'll introduce Carol and Catherine and Cynthia, whom I work with at the American English and Culture Program at Arizona State University. They're three of our wonderful instructors. And they've been flipping the classroom there. And so I asked them to come and talk about some of the basics of flipping the classroom and what they do. So they'll start with kind of a general overview. And then our fourth panelist, who is sitting up here in the front, is Christine Bauer-Ramazzani. She is a former CALIS chair, and she teaches at St. Michael's College in Vermont and teaches in the MA TESOL program, which is a distance program. And so she'll talk about flipping the classroom in the distance education context. Okay. And then Nikki Hockley. Nikki is our IATEFL LT-SIG, is it liaison? Is that what we call you? Okay. So Nikki is runs a consulting business in Barcelona, right? Yeah. And she's got a book coming out called Going Mobile. You can get more information about that from her. She's going to talk about flipping the classroom, in particular using mobile technology. So I think it's going to be a great session, and I'll let you get to it then.
Okay, my name is Carol Kubota, and I teach at the American English Culture Program at Arizona State University. And I have been teaching probably, I don't know, about 30 years. But we have been flipping our classrooms. And I don't know how many of you have been to any of the other flip sessions. Okay, we're going to try and not to make this something that you've already heard about, because we also went to a lot of flip sessions and learned a lot, but everybody, we just wanted to make sure that we said something that would impress upon you. The first thing we would like you to do is to take a look. We did not make PowerPoint, we did not make handouts because we're trying to be eco-friendly, but we would like you to discuss with the people who are sitting next to you. We did notice that there were a lot of people sitting on the end seats. Hopefully you don't want to escape before this is over, but we'll try to make it a little interesting for you. But if you would please take a look at these questions and maybe turn to somebody and discuss them, because these are some of the reasons that we have decided to flip. So if you look at the first question, how much time do you spend getting the class engaged in the material? Do you have students who can't come to class because of extracurricular activities? Do you have students who miss class because of illness? Do you have students who become bored in class? Do you have students who dominate the class? Do you have students whose first language is not English? And do any of you teach online distance courses? Oh, that's not my question, but you can think about that. In a graduate program, have you tried different ways of teaching the content in your online courses? Do most or all of your students have access to mobile devices, such as cell phones or tablets? So this is a long presentation, but we would like to take maybe 5 minutes. Please talk to each other and share some of the answers to the questions. Our question and answer period is going to be after everybody gives their presentation, so you might want to take notes. But please discuss this, and if you come up with anything. So please go ahead. We'll give you 5 minutes, you know, just to talk to each other, you know, intermingle with each other, get to know each other. Give me that when it's over. Go back to the wiki page. Mm-hmm. Do you know how to go back to the wiki page? Yeah, wait just a second. Yeah, this is the this one. And then scroll down. Yeah. 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 Well, I guess I'll come here in 5 minutes. Yeah.
We'll head about 2.
Okay. So I think we'll just go ahead and switch here. Yeah. Yeah, I think they are. Okay. I hope you were able to answer some of the questions. This is kind of what flipping is about. We give something to our students to think about before they come to class so that they can actually discuss it. So all of the questions that were on here will be addressed in our presentation. And so if you have any other questions, please write them down and we'll be happy to address them after we have finished. Okay? So I'm going to give you a little bit of the history of flipping. Actually, flipping started with teaching math and science. And if you have been to the other presentations, you know the famous guys. I think they're Aaron and I can't remember what the guys' names were. But anyway, they started flipping with math and science. some form of flipping. I'm sure all of you, you're not new to this. There is probably some way that you flip in the classroom. And my colleagues here will tell you how they do it. And you might think, okay, well, flipping is all about video lectures and teacher-made videos. You don't actually have to make the videos yourself. There are so many creative people who have created their own videos online. And so we don't really create a lot of ours. We use those that have already been created. And online sources are abundantly available. They're everywhere. Some of the benefits of flipping, it provides more time. I'm sure if you've been to the other flipping presentations, they talked about flipping Bloom's taxonomy. And that's what we want to do. We want to get the students to be able to discuss, analyze, and debate in the classroom. And that's why we give them the work to do outside of the class. It allows students to review the work at their own pace and come to class prepared and to engage in the activity. We all know that we have students who think faster than other students. We have students who speak right away. We have students who need to think about what they say before they speak. So doing a flipping is they have that time. You give them questions. They have the time to think about it. When they come to class, they are prepared to discuss it, to analyze it, to debate. It allows students who are not able to attend class to keep up with reviewing the videos at home. We all have students who don't come to class every day. It could be because they were sick. It could be because they took a vacation, whatever. And it allows students who are more reserved to prepare for class discussions. If you are dealing especially with Asian students, they usually are not prepared to speak immediately. When you call on them, it might take 5 minutes to get an answer. But if they're prepared for it when they come to class, then they're not worried about being embarrassed or about speaking out. Provides second language learners the extra time needed to comprehend the material. We know that our students, our ESL students, need extra time to comprehend what we assign to them, and when they do it at home, they can actually think about it. Maybe they can discuss it with their friends before they walk into class, so that gives them a little extra time. Okay, now my colleague Cynthia is going to talk about what she does in reading and writing.
I'll just use this, I think. It's probably easier. I teach, at the moment I'm teaching an advanced 2 class which requires students to do a very simple research paper. So before I explain what I do, I just want to say I'm not an expert in flipping by any stretch of the imagination. And I've come to the conclusion it's not something you just suddenly decide to do and you start doing it. Like, I think tomorrow I'm going to start flipping and then tomorrow I'm going to start. It's more like as you go along you think, oh, I could give them this to do at home, then I'll have more time for something else in class and so on. So what I'm going to tell you about is kind of where I'm at the moment with moving over to flipping as much as I can. While I was preparing for this presentation the other day, I saw an expression which really spoke to me. It said, students have learned helplessness. Does that speak to you too? Yes, it's about how they come to class expecting not to be able to do things, expecting us to show them how to do things, help them to do things. And I think that flipping can help us to overcome this problem of learned helplessness, make them much more responsible for their learning and for what they do. So in this writing class, one of the advantages that I think flipping has is we discuss what question they're going to write about, what their research question might be about, just give them some ideas. Then they can go home and think more deeply about what they think they might like to do. They can talk to people. They can talk to other students. They can go on the internet and see what's out there and just explore and get some ideas before they actually decide on their topic. And at lower levels, they could do the same thing. If they've been given a writing prompt, they can talk to other students, talk to other people about it to try and get more insight into what it is the teacher actually wants them to write about. Because in my experience, analyzing a writing prompt can often be a problem for them. And then it also, if they've done that at home in their own time, when they come to class, it allows more time for peer discussion, teacher discussion, and helping them to figure out the best way to approach the task, how they're going to do it, what techniques they can use to complete the task they've been given. And then they can go home and start to try it on their own. One thing I found was a big advantage trying to do it this way is I asked the students to go home and find the information they want to use. On the internet, in the library, databases, and so on. And then they come back to class and they actually do the writing in class. While I'm there with them, I go and I sit next to each one of them and discuss what they're planning to write now, how they're going to approach it, what argument they're going to use, is it going to be compare, contrast, whatever. And it allows me time to give them much more guidance about what they are going to write, and then as they get further along, more guidance about what they've written. Face-to-face feedback. Because I think one problem that I have, and maybe other writing teachers have, is you make a lot of comments on their papers, you go to a lot of trouble to give them feedback, and do they read it? Not always. Do they understand it? Not always. So if you're sitting next to them, discussing it with them, then it's much more effective. First of all, because they can't get away from you. They have to listen to what you're saying. And you can judge whether they understand what you're saying, whether you're actually giving them the right tools to improve their work. That's the writing part. And then the reading part, because my class is a reading writing class, I think the reading part is self-explanatory. Instead of sitting reading in class, as Carol said, some read faster, some read slower, some go to sleep, some are busy on their cell phones. If you send them to read at home, and then when they come back to class, you have much more time for the higher level activities and the analyzing and discussing and so on. And it kind of forces them to take responsibility for their own learning. Because if they didn't read, if they didn't do the homework, when they come back to class, they're not going to be able to participate in the activity. And as I said, it allows much more time. I think that's one of the main advantages that a lot of the presentations have mentioned, is that flipping the classroom, giving them the lower levels, and comprehension and finding information and so on to do at home gives us much more time in class to help them develop their critical thinking skills, to help them develop their writing skills and so on. So it does, it makes a lot more quality time with the students. So now, that was reading writing. Now Kathy's going to tell you about her class. Thank you. Oh, sorry. Yeah, but I think I've actually mentioned these things. Yeah. Oh, yes, that's one thing I did. Sorry. I did forget to mention using the videos. While they're looking for information, they can also go to videos, YouTube or wherever, to find videos that will help them to understand the concepts more easily. But I also use videos to help them to understand, for example, how to cite sources and how to write thesis statements and so on. It's something I've found I can explain to them in class again and again and again, and still it seems they don't really remember. So I make short videos on Jing, and I post those on Blackboard, and so they can go back and watch them as many times as they want to. And if they come to me and say, I don't understand, please could you explain again, rather than taking the time to stand and explain the same thing over and over again, I just refer them to the videos and say, watch them again, and then come and ask me if you still don't understand. And so that's all now. This time, definitely.
Thank you. My name is Catherine Warner Bonani. I am an instructor at the American English and Cultural Program with Cynthia and Carol. And I'm going to talk to you about listening, speaking, how I have begun to use flipping in my classes. And most of my classes now are advanced, so some of the things I'm going to talk about are more applicable to advanced students. The first one we've talked about, I mean, if you've attended the other things about flipping here that we've had the other meetings. It allows more time for teacher-student and student-student interaction, of course. And those passive activities, I don't know if you've ever shown a video in class, but you know, when you show a video, it can take up so much time. And then if you ask the students if they understood, some of them will say yes, and some of them will say no, and then some of them will say yes and they're lying, so you really don't know. But it takes a lot of time if you want to show something again or do an activity like that again. So it's so much better if you can let those who need to or those who want to do it at home. It also, at all levels, not just the advanced levels, it allows more time to both the conscientious and those who need more exposure to lectures and videos and other passive materials to watch, listen, and process as many times as they need to without annoying or distracting their other classmates. And this, of course, also contributes to classroom unity and cohesion. Okay. It allows for more time for authentic language activities. All right. Then if they have more of an even level of understanding and comprehension of the material and they come to class maybe the next day, then we can do far more things that flip that Bloom's taxonomy that everybody talks about. We can have very, very meaningful discussions and their vocabulary has already grown. They can already use the concepts and ideas. Okay. And this to me is the most important benefit of flipping for my listening speaking classes. They get to practice authentic academic English, and that's what our goal is. Okay. We also have, this one is very dear to me, allows more time for reserved, either personally or culturally, students to process and prepare for authentic language activities. And Carol mentioned Asian students, of course, sometimes. I find with my Asian students that if I do flip that, and if they know what the assignment is and they know what we're going to do the next day, they are ready. They are ready to talk. You get much more. They're much more ready and confident about speaking. Also, there's always one very shy person who I imagine will even consider dropping a class because they are so shy, and I really relate to that. So if it helps those kinds of students because you can prepare them in stages. Okay, they come prepared, and then you put them in a small group or a round table discussion rather than, you know, showing a video and then putting them with a group of people to discuss something when they're very, very reticent to do so. Okay, helps to build their confidence. All right. Also, in all levels, it allows more time for students to process the information. All right. I think sometimes we assume that students process things at the same time, and of course they don't. All right. We all learn different things at different rates. It gives us more time. For example, when I like to have time to sit with, if I put students in groups, to sit with each of them and get the conversation, to deepen it about whatever they have been assigned to study. All right. And they are encouraged to engage in higher order thinking, all right, asking really important questions. Okay, last session with my advanced students, we did a wonderful unit on exploration of Mars or in possible Martian colonies. And I thought, well, usually I ask them if they want to do that chapter, and they say no. But when they really got into it, we had wonderful time, and they did. They found other things to look at from National Geo, from TED, from all sorts of websites, brought that to the classroom. So suddenly that little kind of dry lecture on exploring Mars became really alive for them. Okay. And it also allows more time for students to process. Oh, that's the same thing. Okay. Oh, I changed mine, not yours. Okay. All right. Now, I think it's very important. I think flipping is not easy. I wouldn't want to leave that impression. In fact, we still have to provide introductions to material. You can't just send students home and say, study this and come back tomorrow. No. You need to create a framework for them to absorb the material you assign for them to study at home on their own time. So we need to introduce it first. Then we need to assign videos and lectures related to the topic to enhance their student interaction, but basically ownership, okay? You know, when you introduce something in class, okay, it's class stuff. But if you're watching it at home, maybe you'll talk to your roommate will say, what are you doing, or wife or spouse or somebody, it just has more meaning that way. It's much more personal. Okay, and some of the videos that I know all of you and I have used come from Khan Academy, YouTube, TED Talks, and more. Okay, of course, many more. I have been particularly inspired as a teacher by the effect of TED Talks. How many of you use TED Talks? Yeah. Do you use TED-Ed or TED? TED-Ed. I like TED-Ed because it has the little quizzes and things, and the students really practice their comprehension that way. But I especially like the TED lectures, the regular ones, because my advanced students, I have them fill out a form on what made that speaker effective. And now I have seen in my classroom something I call the TED effect. Students will come out and they will try, you know, just like a TED speaker, no notes, nothing, and then they'll start delivering with this confident demeanor. It's really nice. I've seen it happen over and over again. So, and it's because of the TED lectures, I believe. Okay. I have used the TED Talks with my Advanced One listening speaking, and I assign them not one video. We can all watch different videos, but on the same subject. And in order to make it work, okay, because I said flipping's not easy. You can't just say go do this. I assign them a search word or a playlist to choose from. And, for example, this session I had them all come back and they actually had to give a presentation on their TED Talk that they watched, why they liked it, what was good about it, why did you choose it, etc. And then the next time, because you can't do that all the time, takes too much time, they have to write a summary for me to make them accountable for that. And it's always related to the subject in their textbook. So we're able to move in the textbook and have some fun. Okay. TED-Ed's nice too, except you don't have so many people speaking where you can ask those kinds of questions. All right. Now, I am probably the least technically savvy person in this room, but I like technology. I am not a Luddite. I am just, you know, it's a high learning curve for me. So I would encourage anyone out here who is like me, test the waters first. I find the more I do it, the more I want to do it, the more I see the benefits. as we were saying before we started, it's not something you can just say, okay, tomorrow I'm going to start flipping. No, I wouldn't do that unless you've had a course. Okay, we are doing this without teacher training. We are learning as we go along. And there are more and more resources becoming available to us to give us some guidance what to do next. Now, one thing I have discovered, flipping requires, for me anyway, a lot more prep time. I have to send something home with them. I have to make it available. We use Blackboard or a paper handout. Sorry, something that will guide their study. Okay, as they view a video or do an activity at home, and then also have something really structured ready for the next time when we come together to make it even more meaningful, so we can get to that higher order thinking, critical thinking, question, debate. But I have discovered, and I used to discover this once in a while. Now I see it more and more because of flipping, that the benefits are vast and deep, but the preparation has to be honed persistently and methodically to suit you and your style and motivate and inspire your students. Thank you.
Okay, I think we're going to hand this over to our next two speakers. Thank you. Like I said, we will have a question and answer period after all of us have spoken, but hopefully you have learned something.
Okay. So please write down questions so that you don't forget them. We're going to be talking about different contexts for the flipped classroom, so make sure you don't forget your questions because they're coming at the end. Okay, I'm Christine Bauer-Ramazani. I teach at St. Michael's College. I do appreciate the talks about the Intensive English Program. I'll be returning to my Intensive English Program course, and also to my graduate course, and I have several graduate students here in the audience, a graduated one from more than 10 years ago, and a current one. So it's good to have you guys here. All right, so we're going to be talking today, or I'm going to be talking about a different kind of context. So the question that we had up at the beginning, do any of you teach online or full distance course in a graduate program? 2, 3, 4, 5. Uh-huh. About 5 or 6 of you. Good. Okay. So the next question, have you tried different ways of teaching the content for your online course? That is, of course, the tricky issue. How will you deliver that content? Mm-hmm. So lecture capture, has somebody tried that with audio, video, and screen capture? Yeah, a couple of you, 3 of you. Okay. Lecture notes, posting lecture notes. Yeah, okay. And any other ways that you have taught the content? Okay. Lane, do you want? You flip, yeah. So hence what I'm going to talk about here is something that I tried out. You know, the research on flipping classroom shows that there's a lot of experimentation and a lot of trial and error. And so I just, you know, I didn't really read the literature on it before I did it, but I just experimented and it worked. And so that's when I started reading the literature and thinking about, oh, what, you know, what am I doing here? And it fits in with a particular context. So that made me pretty happy. So here's the context that I was faced with. I had to teach, well, I taught a course face-to-face 1 week, and online the next week. And this particular graduate course was then going to be part of an online strand in our MATSOL program. And the online strand means that it's a mixture of on-campus and distance courses. And so there are in total 4 distance courses that they take, but in between they come to our campus for the summer and take face-to-face courses. Then they go back to their countries or institutions and take distance courses, 2 of them in the fall semester and 2 of them in the spring semester. And then in the following summer, they come back to campus for more face-to-face courses. So in total, we have a 36-credit program. It has these 12 credits at distance, and the remainder is taught face-to-face. So I had taught this curriculum and syllabus design course face-to-face 1 week and online the next week, and I had to transition it to a fully distance course. A full distance course. So that was my task, and I was trying to figure out how to do that. And, you know, especially the part where my students, I had a captive audience face-to-face on campus for 100 minutes each week. So how to morph that into an online piece, and especially what to do with the content. That was the task that I was faced with. So in the traditional class, you know, graduate program, you have some lecture. I had them look at cases, situations. I elicited a lot of the concepts. I don't lecture at them all that much, but I elicit the concepts and then confirm, okay? Use the smart board a lot to annotate based on what they say. There were lots of small group activities, sometimes pairs, sometimes triads, where they had to explore something. They were given a task, and they had to discuss it and then come back and tell the large group the rest of their result of their discussions. Then they had to go back into the learning management system and post the summaries for readings and also post discussions based on prompts that I had posted and prompts that the moderators in the course had posted. And then the second week, they would go online only. I had posted documents that showed applications of what we had discussed in class. Okay, and they had to discuss those in the thread of discussions. Then there were projects, of course, and peer reviews. All right, so that was the task, and I needed to decide how to make the content engaging, how to keep the course as interactive as it was before, and of course how to meet the goals of the course in general. So, and that's when I started thinking more about this concept here, and I've been teaching online for a long time, but never really in lecture mode, and this particular course, curriculum and syllabus design is not like my call course where I can post a ton of links and, you know, have projects and the students go look at them. So I had to do something slightly different. Excuse me. So I decided to experiment a little bit, and I decided to adapt the flip classroom model with the pillars of flip learning by creating opportunities for the students to experiment. So the F in FLIP stands for the flexible environment. And basically that means the students, of course, in the online course were able to choose when and where to learn. Now obviously they had a week to complete their assignments, and so wasn't exactly deciding when and where to learn, but they had to do it within 1 week. But still, you know, it was up to them exactly on which day and what part of the day to do this. So it was much more flexible than before, where they had to sit in my classroom for 100 minutes. I also experimented a little bit with chats, delivering a lecture in a chat. That worked to some degree as well, but I'll tell you in a minute what worked best according to what my students said. Okay, so the learning culture, which is the L in FLIP, it needed to continue to be learning-centered, and I've experimented with this in my call course, call online course a lot, so I wanted to have the co-construction of knowledge to be the same as it was in the face-to-face course before and also in my call course. Okay, then the I stands for intentional content. And so besides the lecturing that I did a little bit of, I wanted there to be peer construction and I wanted there to be a lot of problem-based learning. And that was not very different from what they had done before, but I wanted to be sure that that continued. Okay, then the fourth point, the P stands for professional educator. I wanted my role in that course to be more of monitoring what the students were doing. I wanted to be doing formative assessments with them on an ongoing basis, and I wanted them to be accountable to the course and to the learning outcomes. Okay, so then what did I actually do? Well, I met with them face-to-face before the course began. I gave them an orientation meeting and recorded it with lecture capture, and that is we use Tegrity as a lecture capture tool. So what you see over there is this is just a screenshot of that recording. Okay, and face-to-face orientation, I just told them basically what to expect in the rest of the course. Okay? So as I said, I used the lecture capture tool for that. I also told them what they were going to see in the rest of the course, and what I had decided to do in the meantime was to flip that classroom by just providing very short, 20 minutes, that was my target, of lecture that still included some of the cases and sample situations that we had discussed in the face-to-face course before. I would post in that recording samples of documents, discuss them there, and some online links for their assignment to be completed and discussed in threaded discussions in our learning management system. And as I said before, I wanted the course to be as interactive as before, so I needed to be sure that there were applied concepts that they had to discuss. They had to analyze documents, they had to analyze links, they had to synthesize the information that they found, and they had to evaluate what they saw and what had been discussed based on Bloom's taxonomy. So Bloom's taxonomy goes from remembering all the way to up the critical thinking levels to analysis, synthesis, and then evaluation. Okay, so what I decided to do then was every second week they had a 20-minute recording, and I checked it. You know, one of them was 19 minutes, another one was 22. So on average, I pretty much targeted my 20 minutes there and used this Tegrity lecture capture tool. I used the microphone, PowerPoint slides, links to internet sources, and documents that I made available. And they had to look at them. They had to listen to the recording, watch the recording, and then there were tasks and assignments around this. And the tasks and assignments I structured in such a way that the students had to analyze particular documents that I had uploaded that showed the application of the concepts that I was discussing in curriculum and syllabus design. And then on the right side, you see an example of an assignment. They had to go into what I call the sharing what you learned forum in the learning management system and discuss those items with their classmates. And I always have moderators, so there is a starter and a wrapper. And one of my students is here. She has been through this system. Okay, so they had to post a response to the recording. There was a prompt in the course. They had to discuss the cases, the samples in the mini lecture, and factors that they would consider in curriculum design. So each course looks like this. Okay, at the top, I always have the topic, followed by goals and learning outcomes that I expect for the students to achieve that week. So this is just an example. I think it was from week 6 or 7 in the course. And so what we discussed in that particular week, I don't know if you can read it. It's a little bit faint, but here was the IEP goals, objectives, the curriculum, and assessment. And this is the document, the curriculum document from the intensive English program at St. Michael's College. Okay, so they were excerpts of that, and they had to discuss those particular elements. I think there are seven items. Okay, and then go back and discuss that in their in the course in the discussions. So I was going to. This is linked to a recording, and I hope it's going to work for our online audience. We've pre-tested this. There were some problems, but I think the link is being sent to them, and they can listen to it on their own. Okay, I'm just going to show a brief excerpt.
We're going to talk about part 2 of our basic curriculum, which is, from goal statements to the curriculum. And we will be looking at samples. So our first sample that we're going to look at is the Intensive English Program Goals and Objectives, its curriculum, and the assessment of it. This is linked in eCollege. It is a handout there, so I will look at that sample with you. And we will take a look at the items, the 7 items mentioned here. Okay, so once again, this link is in your program in eCollege in week 7. Under task 2, IEP mission, goals, objectives, curriculum, and assessment. Okay, so in front of you, you have the IEP mission statement here, which we looked at last week. So I'm going to forward this now to the goals of the Intensive English Program. Okay, as you see.
Okay, I think you get the picture, right? Okay, so I'm going to stop it here and go back to my PowerPoint. Okay, so each week followed that kind of mode with links and documents that I discussed, and then the students had in the course more of those links. So there are examples of the tasks. Okay, so this is a different one from a different week. So in this particular one, the students were given the instructions of what to do. They had to look at scope and sequence samples from in different contexts, so an academic English context, an adult's life skills context, business English context, the links went on and on. So I tried to customize the course as much as possible to the learner's actual situations and their future learning and teaching situations. So they had to select the samples in their own curriculum area, then analyze them, synthesize with, of course, the readings that they should have done, and sharing their findings in the online threaded discussions. Then a very important element of all my online courses is peer reviews. And you see there are some instructions here of who was the peer review, whose project. Then there is a link to the performance inventory that I used. First, they used that to review each other's work, and then I used it to review their work. Okay, then finally there was, I think there are 6 projects in the course with a portfolio project at the very end. And the projects, and there's an example here of one of those projects where they had to come up with a basic curriculum with mission and goal statements. And here are the specifics of that. These are just screenshots from inside the course. And the projects all had to synthesize what they had learned from all of those sources, from the mini lectures, which were 20 minutes, the readings, the reviews of applied and interactive tasks, the interaction in the threaded discussion forum with the peers and me, and the peer reviews. Okay. Now, what are the advantages of using this FLIP model, or what I call an adapted FLIP, because it's in an online course, so it's not exactly the FLIP that you normally get. So for the teacher, I found that I was able to merge the face-to-face and online instructions very well. It was very effective. The students found that it worked very well, and they really liked those 20-minute lectures because they knew that they were going to give going to get some important information there that then they would have to take back to their weekly discussions, and they knew what was expected. Okay. It gave me some increased flexibility because I was able to do those recordings ahead of time. Now, that of course also meant having to do some scripting, which did eat up my time a little bit, but still, you know, it did make for a little bit more flexibility. And very importantly, I was then freed up to focus on this, on assessing the students' work during that week and focus on their on the formative assessment. For the students, there was a lot more interaction because with that 20-minute lecture they knew what was expected, and they could then, once they've listened to that, they could focus on applying this in their discussions, and the discussions were very, very engaging. There was more in flexibility on their part as well because they could choose when to do this. And as I said before, because of the chosen context, they could customize their learning based on their teaching situation. So I did have to find links to all sorts of different environments, which was, it did make for some work. There was more autonomy. Students were responsible for their learning and for the outcomes. Okay, for the students, of course, it was important to see how this meshed with, you know, they were taking an online course, so that was already 21st century instruction. Then using this flipped classroom model, which I talked about a little bit, you know, it kind of fit in with what they were expecting, so that also was good. Challenges, yes, I alluded to the increased preparation time for me, but I still would continue to do it that way. So the video recordings added some more time with the scripting, rehearsing them, you know, not on the first take, but it usually took 2 or 3 times to do it. Searching for all of those links, that took up probably most of my time, and finding appropriate documents and uploading all of them, and then designing the tasks around them. Monitoring and assessing, yeah, I usually do that anyway. It is pretty time consuming during the week to do that. For the students, there were some challenges as well. Most of the time it worked just fine, but as you probably know, in a flipped classroom, there is more emphasis on homework. Okay, so that sometimes students are happy about that, sometimes not so happy. And, of course, they needed to have access to those video sources at home. Okay, and these are the references that I used for presenting this talk. So thank you very much, and I'll turn it over. Okay, I'll turn it over to Nikki.
Hi, everybody. Just talk amongst yourselves while we sort out the presentation. Great. Okay. We'll do. Thanks. My name is Nikki Hockley. I'm based in Barcelona in Spain. So I'm not really accustomed to the weather that you've laid on for this conference, I have to say. This is my first TESOL conference, and it's also my first time in Portland. How many of you are new to Portland? Could you put up your hand? Oh, pretty much everybody. Okay. Well, I don't know if you, like me, I did a bit of research before I came to find out something about the city. And the thing that seemed to kind of come up most in searches is that Portland is quite weird. And having walked around town, I sort of agree. People certainly have a very different kind of dress sense around here, that's for sure. But I did find out some very interesting things about Portland that I want to share with you. The first one is that there is, in case you want to come again, an annual World Naked Bike Ride. You want to put that on the agenda. Also, it apparently has more strip clubs per capita than any other U.S. city. So I have to say I'm very relieved to see that you're all clothed. Okay. So my name's Nikki. I'm a teacher and a teacher trainer. I'm a trained language teacher, not a technologist, but I do like technology. And I want to look specifically at how mobile might work within this idea of a flipped classroom. Now, my interest in mobile comes basically from, first of all, I've been writing a book with my colleague Gavin Deedney about mobile learning, which is going to be published in a couple of months. I'll give you a link towards the end of the session with more information. But I was involved in a kind of an action research project last summer, teaching in Cambridge in a language school, in which I wanted to try out with students specifically a bring your own device, BYOD, bring your own device model of mobile learning, which I then did. So I'm going to draw on my experiences from working with these students and try and illustrate how this sort of fits into a model of the flipped classroom. Okay? That's the idea anyway. Just very briefly, flipping, as far as I understand it, tends to mean what we've talked about so far, right? Out of class work, it's often grammar activities, you know, learning vocabulary, maybe doing some extra listening work, some reading and writing. That's some very good examples of this from the first group of speakers. That can be done, for example, via a virtual learning environment, which is exactly what Christine was showing us. It could be done via a book or the course book, possibly web materials, you know, listening to TED talks, whatever it might be, and also via apps. Now, it seems to me that this model of looking at the flipped classroom creates a very clear division between what we do in class and what the students do at home, which we used to call homework, and we now call flipping. That's fine. But there's clearly a kind of division between stuff we do in class and stuff that you do out of class, which is mainly self-study. And I wanted to look at how mobile devices might be able to bridge that very clear distinction. Now, mobile learning itself, there are many ways of defining it, and it gets more and more confusing the more you think about it. What does it mean, mobile learning? Does it mean that you're walking around in the streets, you know, doing vocabulary apps? Does it mean that you're using augmented reality? What exactly is it? Nobody can quite agree. There is a very clear definition, though, from Mark Pegram in a book that he has coming out right now on mobile learning, and he kind of divides it into these three categories, which I find very useful. It's a very way of understanding what mobile learning is about. He says, first of all, the devices can be mobile devices. In other words, in the classroom, instead of using laptop computers or books and so on, we can be using mobile devices. Okay, so the devices are mobile, the objects that we learn with. His second kind of category is when the learners are mobile. So they're moving around, possibly in the classroom, possibly around the school grounds and possibly doing things at home with their mobile devices. I'm going to come back to these three categories, by the way, to illustrate them. And his final point is this idea of when the learning experience is mobile, which is kind of a combination of all of those things. And this is probably where the most sort of disruptive model of learning can be placed. And again, I'm going to come back to each of these categories and try and illustrate them, because when we talk about theory, it's very often difficult to understand what that actually means. So the first idea of devices being mobile, I just want to make sure I don't misquote Mark on this. But the basic idea is you're using the device, a mobile device, in the classroom or possibly in a flipped model at home. Okay? Let's look at the typical sorts of things that you can do. ESL or EFL apps, there are many, many, many of these things, all of the above. Vocabulary, grammar practice, pronunciation games, whatever you like. There are also authentic apps, so not specifically made for language learners. And probably the more interesting category is the idea of communication apps, again, and you use your mobile device for communication. I'll just give you a quick example there. I've said they're networks, so you're accessing these social networks via your mobile device, Twitter, Facebook. WhatsApp is, of course, another one. And the great thing about WhatsApp, if you're familiar with WhatsApp, could you put up your hand? I think pretty much everybody will be. Okay, so it's a kind of a SMS messaging system. You can set up a group. And I used this with my group of students in Cambridge. A little task as an example that I set them was the 6 o'clock selfie. The 6 o'clock selfie. Selfie is a self-portrait that you take with your mobile device. It's actually in the Oxford Dictionary now. It's put in this year. And this just meant that because we had classes in the morning, they left school at about 4 in the afternoon. It was an intensive course over the summer. At 6 o'clock in the evening, they had to take a selfie of themselves and then bring it to class. And that was great. It was very interesting just in terms of discussion. They would sit in small groups, show their selfie, and explain what they were doing at 6 o'clock the day before. And we had some great photos, one of the students lying in the park doing a selfie lying on the grass, another one with a mouth like this of spaghetti eating something. You know, that's just a nice little idea of how you can integrate this idea of using a mobile device for a very specific language task. Okay, here are just some examples of ESL apps. I'm sure you know all of these. Are there any apps that you particularly know and love and recommend to your students? Yeah, you like sounds? Mm-hmm. Dictionary apps? Yeah, anything else? I mean, there are many. I just put up a few here to show you the range of functions that you can get. I particularly like the British Council apps. I would recommend you check those out if you don't know them. The British Council were pretty much the first in our field to start developing apps for English language learners. And their apps often integrate a kind of a social component. The publishers came afterwards, but theirs tend to be fairly behaviorist driven, which is fine. There's a place for memorization in the language class. But that's just a quick sort of overview of apps. And that's one way of using mobile devices with apps, probably the least interesting way, in my view. The second way is this idea of when the learners are mobile, okay? And how does that work in terms of activity types? Well, this is often the idea of on the move. You often hear the words mobile learning and on the move used in the same sentence, right? That somehow learners are constantly on a bus and they're constantly with a mobile device and they're constantly doing some kind of learning activity, okay? I personally don't know many learners who do that, but this is a kind of a myth that we have in our profession. But the idea, again, is that the learners are kind of mobile somehow, moving around, and they're probably using apps. And then the second way of looking at this is when the students are moving around the school environment or the classroom environment. And I want to give you a few examples of actually how I did this with my students. This is just one very simple activity, easy to do. The school I was working in, I had to use a course book, which will remain nameless. It was part of the deal. I didn't want to, but I had to integrate somehow the course book into this project, which was actually a very good thing for me to do, because that is the reality for most teachers, that you do need to teach to a syllabus and a course book. The course book theme was water. The topic of the unit was water. I don't know if anybody recognizes the course book, but Unit 3, water. So what we did was, you know how we would put water on the board and then we'd get students to brainstorm, right? And then we'd write the stuff on the board. It would be the typical way into a topic that we've been doing for the last, 50 years or more. I decided to try something a little bit different. I wrote water on the board and I said, okay, you've got 10 minutes, go out around the school and take 4 or 5 photos that you associate with the idea of water. So don't take photos of water. Take photos of things that you associate with it. And then I sent them all off. They all had cell phones, by the way. This was a private language school in the UK, a specific demographic, a specific type of student, okay, with catering to the wealthy language student. So I kind of knew when we implemented the BYOD model what the students would have. They had a lot more than I expected, I have to say. They all had at least iPhones and some had 2 phones. One for the UK and one for back home. Yeah, I mean, we're talking about a very specific group of students. But this can, of course, work with a very basic cell phone, this idea. So I gave them 10 minutes. I sent them all out of the classroom. I didn't really know if they would come back. They did, luckily, with their photos. And then what we did was we shared the photos in our WhatsApp group, because the problem with mobile devices, if you're using phones as opposed to tablets, is screen size. So if you have a group of 15 students, I mean, they just can't see each other's photos. So we shared them, and then we looked at them all, and the students had to say what their photo was of and how it was connected to water. And here's just a couple of them in the second part. I just put 4 photos together. We have a drain pipe there on the left. Of course, this was an intermediate group. They didn't know the word drain pipe, so that came up. The right-hand side, there is a sink from the bathroom. The left-hand bottom there is a pot plant. And then the fourth one is a fire extinguisher. And the students had to justify their choice. Of course, with the fire extinguisher, everybody went, well, what's that got to do with water? It's not connected. And the students said, no, but you do get fire extinguishers that have water and not foam. And of course, we didn't believe him, so he, Googled it and he showed us and so on. The point I'm trying to make here is that a lot of discussion ensued from basically a kind of an adapted brainstorming task. A very simple task. It was very interesting to see how interested the students were in talking about these things, which are not very interesting. I mean, a drain pipe is not an interesting object in itself. But when students need to justify their choice and they're being quizzed on it by other students, it takes on a different kind of dimension. There's a kind of ownership to the activity that you don't get when you're looking at photos that are in the course book. So a nice activity. I've put a link there to a blog post at the bottom which describes the exact stages that I went through to set up the activity in the classroom in case you want to try it. And just again to say, you can do this activity with the absolute most basic type of cell phone. You obviously don't need a smartphone for this or any kind of connection. Okay, another type of activity which works on this idea of learners being mobile is one that I did around the school with a group where we just put QR codes in various locations. The students had to read the QR codes and then do a number of tasks. The tasks included taking a photo in the school canteen of what was for lunch that day. It included going to reception, finding out the names of the people who worked in reception and writing them down, because you know how English surnames, you know, it's not always Smith. You often have to listen to how things are spelt. It included, bottom right, interviewing the director of studies about her hobbies, her job, and so on, and audio recording it. So you can see 2 of the students, they're both holding their cell phones, and they're recording the interview. So then for homework, they had to listen to the interview again and write up a paragraph about the DOS, about the Director of Studies. We have 10 things in total. I've put a note there to say logistics, because when you've got 10 QR codes in 10 different areas in the school, you have to kind of prepare it in advance. You also need to get permissions. So in my case, I was having the students go to reception. They had to ask the receptionist's name, and the instructions also said take a photo. So they had to ask permission. Now the interesting thing is when I went myself to get permission the day before, one of the receptionists said, no, I don't want my photo taken. So I said, that's great, good. The students are going to ask you politely, and then you're going to say no. I mean, it's perfect. You know, the students, you know, they actually are in a real situation asking for permission, and they're getting a no, which was great. So that was all fine. Again, there's a link to a blog post which goes through the specific stages of this lesson, because the logistics behind it are a little bit complex. I don't want to get into it now because I've only got 20 minutes. But if you're interested in trying this out with your students, again, there are the stages. You do need a smartphone to be able to read QR codes, by the way. Okay. All right, so that's all fine. But let's look at perhaps what's a little bit more interesting, where the actual learning experience becomes mobile. And we're talking about something slightly new here, slightly different. The tasks in this case are what mobiles bring to the whole learning experience, the fact that they are mobile. So your learning can take place outside. You can interact with the environment, and it kind of, it can involve slightly more informal learning, you know, not apps, which is pretty much formal learning. Tasks that rely on the specific affordances or the specific or special properties of smart devices are what make things interesting here, I think. So geolocation, AR, augmented reality. And these are the tasks, I think, that can bridge this division between in-class and out-of-class, because we can have stuff happening in between. And again, let me give you a couple of very quick examples. Here's a task we did with the intermediate group involving geotagging and using a free cross-platform app, cross-platform, so you can use it on BlackBerry, iPhone, or iOS, and Android. It's called Voices with a W. Actually, I haven't put the name of the app. Oh, there it is, yes, in the second point, Voices. Now, the students, we were in Cambridge, the students had to basically contribute to an audio guide about Cambridge using this app. The top thing there is one of the recordings that one of the students made, and the thing down there was the students researching. So they had to, first of all, listen to a couple of these audio recordings that other people had made, because it's a public app. So there is stuff about your city there, for sure. Then they had to choose a location in Cambridge that they thought was nice or that they particularly liked and research it. And the top screenshot there is from one of the students who was very interested in the science park in Cambridge. I thought everybody would make recordings about King's College, but this particular student was interested in the science park, which I knew nothing about, actually. So he researched it and recorded it. And you can see that he used under my username, because he didn't have his phone with him, so I just gave him my phone and we used my account. I'm trying to see if there's a link. There's a link at the end, but you can listen to these recordings as well from the students, which are interesting. The students had to prepare a script for this, and they had to rehearse, because of course this is where the language learning takes place, and that's what we're all about. We're not about fancy apps and fancy devices. We're about language, and if we can enhance the experience with apps, that's fine, but the important part is the scripting and the rehearsal, and that's where the class time needs to go. It needs to go on the language work. Then they recorded and they uploaded their recordings to Voices, which pins it to a map, which means that anybody who goes to the science park and opens up Voices, they will have that recording pop up in situ. That's the nice thing about Voices. You can be anywhere in the world. In fact, they will be here for Portland. Open it up and poof, you'll get audio recordings about the place. Then what they had to do over the weekend was to find more around Cambridge, note down the things that they learned, and then come back to class and share it. Okay, so we're trying to kind of use geolocation to bridge this classroom homework gap. Okay, augmented reality, which I'm sure, if you're familiar with the term augmented reality, could you just hold up your hand? Only a few of you. Okay, well, basically the screenshot sort of shows you. Those of you who already know, bear with me. The idea is that you hold up your device, your smart device, your phone or your tablet. You open up an augmented reality app. In this case, the top screenshot is one called WikiTude. Your camera kind of looks through. The camera figures out where you are through GPS. Says, oh, you're in Portland. And then the thing that you're looking at, you'll get these little pieces of information kind of overlaid on the camera, on the screen. And you can click on those and you'll be taken to a Wikipedia article about that place, which is why it's called WikiTude. So WikiTude is an AR app that links to Wikipedia and gives you information about the place where you are. All right, so again, obviously you need a smart device for this. Jumayo is another one, another well-known AR app that allows you to also create. And there's another very nice one called Aurasma, A-U-R-A-S-A, Aurasma. I actually use Layar to create apps myself, so L-A-Y-A-R. There's quite a few of them around. Okay, so this is a possible activity. Unfortunately, I couldn't carry this out with my students because them being international students in Cambridge, they didn't have 3G access. Okay? One or two of them did, but the majority of the class were using their devices with Wi-Fi, which meant that they had to be in the school Wi-Fi connection, or with their host families, the home Wi-Fi connection, which made the space in between. If it was tasks that required a connection, we couldn't do them. Okay, so obviously the types of devices that your students have and the access that they have, if they have 3G or they don't have 3G, severely affects task design. Yeah, this is the obvious conclusion I came to there. But this is one way it could be done, right? So your students choose a location, they research in situ again by using their AR app and finding out information, and then you can have students actually produce AR information as well, okay? Because some of these apps allow you to produce. This is probably like the final step on the ladder, yeah? If you're getting into mobile learning, this is where you end up. So that's where you start, yeah? You start with the simple stuff. Okay. What I sort of discovered from this project that I carried out with two different groups while I was in Cambridge, one group of beginners, one group of intermediate students. A couple of important things. When we're working with mobile devices, we often think that our students are so tech savvy and they know everything. This is just so not true. I found with the group that I had, which was mainly 16 to 25 year olds, most of them were around the age of 16, they were not particularly savvy with their devices for learning English. Of both classes, the only thing they had in terms of English learning on their mobiles were dictionaries. That was it. There was nothing else. They didn't even have QR code readers. This is in both classes. We're talking about, you know, kids mostly from Europe, from the Middle East, and some from Asia, so very familiar with their devices. So again, we need to make sure that the kinds of activities we're setting students are simple, not just in terms of technological complexity, but also in terms of linguistic complexity. So if you hit your students on day one with a really complex AR, you know, audio recording, voices type task, they're having to deal with, first of all, a new app and the linguistic complexity. So staging is important. The tasks need to be related in some way to your syllabus. That's, I found that wasn't actually that difficult to do because course books and syllabi are often, they will often have a kind of a central topic. And it's not that difficult to come up with tasks integrating mobile devices and kind of, you know, related to the topic. The language production needs to take place in class. I think this is important, the rehearsal, the scripting, the pronunciation practice, because that's where you help them. Your job is to help with the language. And the technology comes second to all of that. The idea of bridging the classroom, the in and out of the classroom with mobile devices, and not thinking that mobile learning involves apps. There is life beyond apps, okay? Apps to me seem to be the most limited possible use of mobile devices. It's fine. If students like it, that's fine, but do something a little bit more interesting with your students than that. From my research project, I came up, in fact, with six parameters for task design, if you want to start integrating the use of mobile devices. There's a link there at the bottom, which is a blog post to the research paper that I actually wrote up. But just to give you a very quick summary, it's more or less what we've been talking about. I mean, you have to first of all work to the hardware that's available. What devices do your students have? Yeah, if you're working in a context where they have basic phones or feature phones, well, obviously, tasks are designed for those phones. You're not going to be using augmented reality if your students have got feature phones. Linked to that, the idea of connectivity. Do they have 3G, don't they? Do they only have access to Wi-Fi? Okay, what does that mean for task design? Also the idea of screen size. The difference between using tablets and using phones is a huge difference to task design there because of the way you can actually share them physically in the classroom. The idea of mobility, which we talked about, Mark Pegram's three categories, whether the devices are mobile, the learners are mobile, or the learning experiences are mobile, and that's a degree of simple to complex as well. So you want to be starting at the kind of app level and then working up or down to the AR, augmented reality level. Again, this idea of the balance of complexity between technological complexity and linguistic complexity and making sure that those two work together well, yeah, and is aimed at the level of your students. The type of MOL, I find this interesting, the type of mobile assistant language learning that you're kind of trying to introduce. I see most mobile learning is aimed at the level of content MOL or tutorial MOL. So either we're using mobiles to consume content, or we're kind of doing flashcards. And that's a very behaviorist view of devices. It's fine, there's a place for memorization and behaviorism, yeah, small place. But don't get stuck there. We need to be doing stuff that actually involves communication as well. So we need to have our students using devices to create creation mobile assisted language learning, and communicate. So using WhatsApp, sharing stuff. We need to make sure those are involved. And then the last point I want to make is what I learned on this project, totally unexpectedly. Students all loved it, of course. Yeah, all devices, all heaven. Before we started, I asked them, we did an entrance questionnaire to gauge their attitudes and what they did, nothing. And then I did another one at the end. And I found that one of the students in one of the groups, although we'd had one-to-one feedback and I did a debriefing with all of the groups and interviews and recorded and so on, one of the students, when I got an anonymous questionnaire back, hated it. He said things like, useless, waste of time. This is despite, on a one-to-one basis, him telling me he'd loved it all, okay? So there's a whole kind of, you know, communication with the teacher thing there. The student would not have been comfortable with criticizing me because of his educational background and context. But in the anonymous questionnaire he did, and I knew who it was, because of the types of comments. And that, to me, was probably the most interesting thing in the entire project. For me, the project was worth doing to find that out, to have one student who hated it all. The reason was, this student hated any kind of communicative activity. He didn't like pair work, he didn't like speaking in class, and what he wanted to do was grammar. Grammar exercises, you know, multiple choice, and that was learning for him. That was his experience of learning in his past, learning in his own country, and that was what he thought worked for him. And you know what? Fair enough. There was a certain way to how I carried out this project, walking in telling everybody, we're doing this, you know, wow, AR, voices, and so on, expecting them all to love it. And they, most of them did, but one didn't. So in retrospect, depending on the kind of context you're working in and the students' educational backgrounds and their expectations, you have got to take that into account. Learner training. You start with the kind of app approach. All right, we're using devices over, I had a week, over a period of a term or a year, we all start with apps, okay? Here are the apps, go home, try them out. Do you like them? Share what you do. And then you slowly start to build up to the more complex things. I think I might have been able to get that student on board if I had been able to implement that approach, but actually it didn't occur to me until afterwards. And this is always the interesting thing about a research project, isn't it? When you find the thing that doesn't work, you learn a lot more from that one thing that doesn't work. Okay, I just want to end off then with my details here. There are lots of resources about mobile learning here, blog posts that I've done, lesson plans, all sorts of stuff if you're interested in finding out a bit more. I'd also like to tell you about the book that I have coming out with my colleague Gavin Dudeney, which will be out in about 2 or 3 months. I'm going to add a link to this. I haven't had time yet. I only received the sample material a couple of days ago while I was here. Let me see if I can just find it. This is the cover. I'm going to add the PDF sample material that the editors have just sent us. It's about 12 pages, which shows a couple of different activities I haven't had time to show you, and also talks about implementation plans, because it's not a matter of just walking into your class and saying, okay, let's just do some mobile stuff for a few weeks and then, you know. You can actually do it in a far more structured and pedagogically sound manner than kind of ad hoc off the top of your head every now and again. I hope that was useful and provided a little bit of food for thought and in terms of the flipped classroom made you think about how you can sort of bridge this divide with mobile devices. Thank you.
Thank you. Now we have some time for questions. So if we can ask our panelists to come up here. You have questions from the webcast? Okay. We'll start with a webcast question, or a question from an online audience member.
So we have a question from a man in Cairo, and she writes about the preparation time problem. So far everyone identifies it as time consuming. Is it more time only the first time around, or every semester do you have to update materials and tailor them to specific topics and themes?
Who would like to tackle that question?
I can
Yeah. I think at the beginning, it does take a lot of time. It takes about, to do just one. I mean, if you're going to do a mobile activity or if you're going to do something like that, it does take time to think about it because you have to think of the reason why you're doing it, how it's going to affect the students, and it does take time to develop it. But the one good thing is once you have developed it, you can use it over and over again. That's what I would say.
Same thing for the online environment, of course. So I'm looking forward to reusing. I hope I can reuse those recordings that I made. I will have to go through them to see if there are any particular references that I made that are no longer appropriate for the class that I will be teaching in the fall. So I will see. But the resources that I have uploaded there will, of course, be applicable again. And I will have to upload some new ones as new ones come online all the time.
Okay. I think in my case, probably the examples that I gave about using mobile learning, you actually save time because the students do all the work. And they do it out of class, especially if you're getting them to create material and their own stuff and then bring that into the classroom. They're the ones who are actually providing the content.
I did want to make a note here that the materials that we have used in this session are all available on the CallIS website. This is for the webcast in particular. If you go to callis2014.pbworks.com, you will see a link to Flipping the Classroom in Multiple Contexts. The webcast recording will be there and the handouts, the PowerPoints, and Nikki, we can add your link to the sample pages for the book, of course.
So her follow-up question is it easy to edit the videos after the fact, after you've already recorded them?
Oh, both mics work? Okay. I will have to re-record. I will probably have to re-record the recordings. Edit, yeah, I've done a little bit of editing and ended up destroying the videos, so I'll give it another try to see if I can just put in a little piece. It is trial and error. It is indeed. But I haven't put as much time into that. But, you know, it doesn't, once you've done the recording once, it doesn't really take that long. So the first one took me a little bit longer and the next one didn't, so I will probably re-record it. I may have some other materials in there anyway, and there may be a different flow that I would prefer, so I'll probably re-record them. I don't know yet, but good question.
Okay. Any other questions?
Sorry.
The book, going mobile will be amazingly an e-book and a print book. Yeah.
This is Antonio. I'd like to know what software you use to record videos, you know, because I try to, I mean, it's difficult to find things that are free.
Well, the one I use, it's called Jing, and there is a free version which limits you to 5 minutes, but you've used Jing, I've used Jing. It's very easy to use. And it shows what you're doing on the screen, and you can give a commentary with it. Well, there are more complicated ones. And Camtasia, I mean, if you do have the money to buy Camtasia, it is expensive. But the thing is, it's also it's got a learning curve that's really high. So once you learn how to use it, it's okay. But Camtasia can be expensive. There are, Jing is one of the free ones, and then I think there are a couple of other free ones. If you go to our wiki space on the questions that we had you answer at the beginning when you walked in, we also have some links down there to freeware and expensiveware. And honestly, I think that it doesn't really have to be us who is doing the recording. We get a lot of our recordings, as we said, from TED Talks, from Khan Academy. We have so many creative people out there creating their own that we can just go and get theirs. Another one that is really easy to use is called My Brain Shark. I don't know if anybody here has used My Brain Shark. It's really easy to use. You just create a PowerPoint, upload it to My Brain Shark, add your recording. You can edit it. You can go back and forth. You can save it. You can embed it. You can do just about anything with it. And I use that. It's really easy and it's free. My Brain Shark is free. Not mine, but the name of it is mine. And SlideShare. I don't know how many people use SlideShare. SlideShare is another one that you can upload videos and things to.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I have a question about flipping online because I just started this fall and it was a huge learning curve for me. I've been flipping for a while, but only face-to-face classes. And flip people say, oh, how can you flip an online class? You know, what do you do? And so one of the things that I've tried, and I just wonder if you thought of it or if you know anyone who's doing it, is that we still meet synchronously once a week in a virtual classroom. Because I felt the first time I tried it, I didn't do that, but then I missed the actual contact with my students with the flip because that's a recording. So I wondered if you could speak to you. Do you think that might make it more, you know, personalized?
I alluded to it. I do have chats built in, and if I remember correctly, in this 15-week course, I had 7 chats. I think it might have been a little too much, but you know, maybe 5 would have been enough. But because I had come off of this face-to-face course before, and the students that I had several from Africa, China, Japan, and they, you know, they were on campus and they felt reluctant to go online the second week. They really felt that they needed to be there, and our director was worried about this too. And so I said, okay, no problem. I will build in chats to make sure that that connection exists. Okay. They felt that it really wasn't that necessary because the course as it was designed was very, very interactive. And so, you know, and with the recordings, they had enough instruction. I think it probably was a little too much. So 5 chats, I think, would have been plenty. So every 3 weeks, I think that would have been enough.
Nikki, you talked about the view of the mobile student that sometimes we have of them sitting on the bus with their devices doing these learning activities, and that really isn't what's happening. What is the actual view of what they're doing with their mobile devices?
What are you saying? They're not learning English.
But where would they be using it for learning? Do they do that at home as homework in their...
I was sort of being slightly ironic perhaps. This kind of is an entire sort of learning theory, which is called the on the bus learning theory, practically. I think there's very little material out there for language learners. What I showed you before, the ESL apps tend to be very similar, and I've actually had a walk around the exhibition center to have a look at what's happening, and it's the same old stuff. And that's fine, you know, you have to memorize vocabulary. And there is actually research, interestingly, into the use of mobile vocabulary apps. Paul Nation is the kind of vocabulary guy, and he's found that retention of vocabulary is better when you use flashcards on a mobile device because they are extremely well structured, because they're programmed for review. They pick out your weak points and then make you review that, and that's all kind of, you know what I mean, they work. If the students use them, they can work. But there's not much else out there. There's the grammar app, the drag and drop, there's the this and the that. So if they are using their mobile devices for learning, it tends to be apps, which is fine. But what I found was that the students I worked with weren't even doing that. They were using it for on-the-spot translation with dictionaries, bilingual, so their own language to English. That was it. There was absolutely nothing else that they were using it for. So my idea as a teacher is that, okay, apps is fine, they can do that out of class, but let's do something interesting with it, because, you know, the device is, it's only a tool. It's not going to fix learning. It's not going to make them learn better. The idea is to try and have solid pedagogical tasks and aims, and then integrate the devices into that to make it a little bit more interesting, to make it a little bit more relevant, to help them develop their mobile digital literacy, for example, the QR codes with my students. They've all seen QR codes before, but they had, none of them had a QR code reader, and none of them knew what they really were, and there was that incredible aha moment. This is with two different classes where they went, oh my God, I've learned what a QR code is. It's not difficult, but maybe they've taught them before. So there was that kind of added benefit, if you like, certainly from my point of view as an educator, to include that sort of digital literacies element, which is my other big thing. Okay.
We have time for a couple more questions.
I'm just curious, how many hours a week do you teach in class? Yes.
I was teaching 25. I usually work in teacher training, but when I go back into the classroom, it tends to be 24, 25.
And for me, it depends on which program I teach in. I typically teach in a mixed program, so if I teach IEP only, it would be 18 hours, but I typically have a mixed assignment, so IEP some hours, then graduate program some hours, and I teach an average program too. So it makes for a very busy week.
I just wanted to explain a little bit. We work in an IEP, and it's probably the same as everybody else, but we teach reading, writing, speaking, listening, and then we have electives that we teach also. So we our speaking and listening classes, that's where we started flipping the class, because they're probably the easiest to flip at first, because the main thing that we want to do is to get our students to speak in class. Because when my students walk out of class, they don't speak English. They speak to their own language. So I always tell them, you know, this is your chance to listen to real English. And then they listen to it, and then when they come in, they can discuss it. So it really adds to their speaking, because as ESL teachers, we know there's not much time for speaking in class. So that's a one thing about flipping, is it adds more time for the students to speak as discussing, in debating, in all kinds of situations.
Oh, yeah. That's allowed. Two questions, actually. One is, where do you mount the links to the outside assignments? And then the second question is, how do you make sure, I mean, I've done that, you know, while I'm at TESOL, my students have a wiki page with assignments to listen to this and read such and such, and I told them when I come back there will be a quiz. So, next Tuesday. But I'm wondering how you deal with, you know, making sure that the assignments are done so that you're ready to flip.
I guess I'm going to speak for everybody. We actually use Blackboard. So Blackboard is our LMS system. And for me, every week in the content area for each class, I plan the whole week out in advance. So on Monday, they have to have this video, you know, listen to, and I always add questions that they have to answer the questions. I think my colleagues all do the same thing. So even though we are here, our students got 2 free days of no class, except if they had a teacher who was not here, but they are responsible for doing the homework. The second question on how we get them to do the homework is if they come to class and I usually give maybe a pop quiz, and I give them maybe 2 questions that they have to answer. If they can't answer those questions, it means they did not listen, and they don't receive the 5 points for answering the 2 questions. I don't know. I think my colleagues do the same thing, but.
Yeah, if I assign them something to do at home, then I want them to, I have to give them something to do in response to that, even if they're all doing something different, so that they're accountable for it. And whether it's a summary or questionnaire or something that will help me know that they did what they were supposed to do. Yeah, and I use Blackboard too. But I'm not as organized as Carol. I tell them about it and then and then I post it on Blackboard.
Any other questions?
You mentioned that you use TED Talks for they listen to something and then they present in class. And they all listen to something different. So do you watch all of the TED Talks? Or how do you address things like, you know, accidental plagiarism in those things when they summarize them?
That's a very good question. Yes and no. I try to know beforehand. That's why I give them a playlist or a search, because then I know what they're choosing from. And usually I've seen at least part of it, so I know what they've seen. And now that I've been doing this quite a while, and if you're using a textbook, you can create lists to go with each section if you'd want to use TED Talks.
And do you select these based on like the majors that your students are going into, or how do you select which areas or which search words to use?
Well, in the class I have right now, I choose it according to the book and the things they, for example, it began with a chapter about slang and language change. Well, from there we could do language, okay. And then another class I had done, one of their lectures that they had to listen to was about, you know, the colonization of Mars and the possibilities there. And we have at ASU, you know, the Mars Museum and all this going on. So I thought, well, this is a great thing for them to study. But we had a very spirit. I had them all watch different things about that. And they came from National Geo, from TED, from other places that they found. And then we got together and in groups of 3 and 4 and talked about different aspects of colonizing Mars. It was really neat. And they were mostly future engineering students, so they had a lot to say about, well, how you couldn't construct this and you couldn't do that and you don't want to do that. And so it was really good. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it.
One more question.
This isn't actually a question. This is a kind of an announcement. Christine had mentioned the Flip Learning Network, and there's actually if you haven't gotten enough of Flip Learning, there's actually a Flip Learning conference every year, an annual Flip Learning conference, and it's all flippers, the whole conference. And there are 2 things to know about it. One is that the conference is flipped. So all presenters must put all of their materials up in advance, and you're supposed to select what you're going to attend, and you come in already prepared with having viewed the materials in advance, so they practice what they preach. The other thing about it is that you can attend it virtually. I actually did this a couple of years ago. It costs a lot less, and you really do. It's a great experience. We have virtual people here today. That whole conference is a virtual conference. So it's the Flip Learning Network is fliplearning.org, and all the information on the conference is at that site. Flipped learning.org. IEP.org.
Okay.
Thank you very much for coming, for staying later on a Saturday afternoon. We appreciate it, and thank you very much to our panelists and our online audience.
Thank you, too. Thank you.